Just to start off, my name is Dao, and I'm a member of the International Socialist Organization, part of the branch up here in Morningside / Columbia Heights. And on behalf of the International Socialist Review, Verso Books, Monthly Review, and the Center for Economic and Social Rights, I'd like to welcome everyone to this panel tonight on resisting empire, U.S. empire. I hope that this will be the first of many future collaborations. And I should mention also that tonight's meeting is endorsed by the ISO and by the Columbia Student Solidarity Network. We're also very, very pleased to have with us tonight People's Radio, WBAI, along with several other community media outlets who will be taping this event, so people should be aware of that. And it may be broadcast at a later date on the excellent program Democracy Now! That many of you might be familiar with. I also want to just make sure that people know about the tables in the back. We have, you know, several activist groups and publishers in the back that people should check out, especially the International Socialist Review table. There are special subforms on your chairs, and there are lots of back issues available. For people who don't know, the ISR is a socialist magazine that was started 1995, I believe. And the current issue has a lead article on civil rights and civil wrongs, which is about racism in Bush's America, and also includes an exclusive interview with Noam Chomsky on U.S. imperialism. And tonight's panel is an example of how this magazine attempts to not just, you know, give an analysis about the world and current politics, but also be a vehicle for debate and discussion on the left. And we're very, very lucky tonight to have with us a group of internationally renowned speakers, who I will introduce in each turn in detail, who are going to address the Bush administration's war and occupation of Iraq and the resistance to it. Unfortunately, one of our scheduled speakers, Gilbert Achkar, will not be speaking tonight since he was delayed in his flight and because of bad weather. And he sends his solidarity and his greetings, and he's sorry that he can't be with us. However, he will be speaking tomorrow, for those of you who are interested, along with Mike Davis and others at a conference up at Columbia here on anti-imperialism. I'm sorry? Oh, it's Friday. Sorry, Friday. Okay, so a few words of introduction about why we're having this meeting. In Iraq, of course, people know the U.S. forces are up against the resistance that even the CIA is being forced to admit has the support of the vast majority of ordinary Iraqis. And within the military and among veterans, a small but very important and powerful resistance is building to Bush's occupation. And when Bush traveled last week to Britain, he was met by a midweek demonstration of at least 150,000. And even though, you know, even those of us in this room may have once thought that Bush was hard to challenge or beat, it's clear that he's being met with resistance from all sides. And in this panel tonight, we hope to pull together the many different aspects of opposition to U.S. empire, both not just abroad, but in the U.S., in the U.S. armed forces, and most crucially, in Iraq itself. And while these strands are not united in form or organization, they do form a broad movement that is united in its aims. And we believe that those aims are to see what's happening currently with the resistance to U.S. empire and to help ensure that it broadens and grows. So let me first introduce Lou Plummer, who served in the North Carolina National Guard for 6 years. Today, he is an anti-war activist and a member of Military Families Speak Out. His son, Drew. His son, Drew, who was recently featured in a Robert Fisk piece that ran in The Guardian, has served in the Navy since June of 2001 and is currently stationed aboard the USS Dwight D. Eisenhower. In March, Drew spoke out against the war on Iraq at a peace vigil in Fayetteville, North Carolina, and was charged by the Navy for making disloyal statements. Lou is also on the coordinating committee for Bring Them Home Now, and he was recently in Paris at the European Social Forums speaking to large crowds as a representative of the U.S. anti-war movement. Please join me in welcoming Lou Plummer.
Thank you. Just want to tell you a little bit about the place where I live. It's a town, Fayetteville, North Carolina, which is right outside of Fort Bragg. Fort Bragg is one of the largest military bases in our country. It's the home of the 82nd Airborne and the U.S. Army Special Forces Command, the Green Berets. And you would think in a community that size that there would be lots of opportunities for the government to help troops, but I'm just going to read you a letter that I got last week. And Fayetteville's not a big town, and believe it or not, there's not a whole lot of ex-GI anti-war activists marching around the streets. A couple people in town know who I am, and I get this letter in my email from a woman who is pretty strident pro-government supporter, supported the war, and I just want to read this to you and kind of let you know when our government says support the troops, what they're doing and how people perceive us and what we're doing. The letter starts, "Dear Lou, I think I need your help. We have a soldier from our unit that was horrifically injured in Iraq. This kid is 20 years old. He's blind. He lost part of one leg, some of his hearing. He's had 26 surgeries so far. He's now medically retired in Pennsylvania and having the worst time. I guess it's hitting him all at once. Can you help steer me towards some veterans groups, disabled vet groups, etc.? I'd really like to find some organizations that might be able to provide him with some services." When the folks on this side have to write folks on this side to get help for people who have a life like this kid's got, there's something wrong with our country. And when the government says support the troops, and what they really mean is support the government, and people think that by going out in their yard and tying a yellow ribbon around a tree that they're doing something to support someone, they're not. The best way to support a soldier, and a soldier's nothing but a human being with a uniform on. That's all this is about. It's about humanity. The best way to support that person is to bring them back home to their families. I talk to GIs pretty much every day because of where I live and because of my background, and I look for opportunities to speak to them. It's a great place to organize outside of a military base because you can do it when you're standing in line at the grocery store or when you're getting a cup of coffee or you're at the library. And when the word gets out that I'm, you know, one of those anti-war people, and I get in a good conversation, you know, I start asking, what about the criticism that we always get that we're hurting your guys' morale? You know, what I'm told is we're not the ones that lied to them. You know, contrary to what some people believe, the U.S. government doesn't have a school somewhere called How to Occupy a Third World Country. And so these guys are over there doing jobs that they were never trained to do. And they're paying a price for it, and unfortunately the people of Iraq continue to pay a price for one stupid government after another one. The other thing that people want to hang on folks like us is, you know, isn't this all just part of some big anti-Bush agenda? Well, yeah, I mean, it is. but George Bush is not Congress. And last time I checked, there were a couple of parties in Congress, and they both voted for this war. They both voted for the $87 billion. And, you know, I may be a radical. I may be out there. But I think that those people in Washington don't represent working class people like the people that are serving in the military. The occupation of Iraq is wrong. And friends, there is no right way to do a wrong thing. We can't make a kinder, gentler occupation. We can't put blue helmets on U.S. troops and say this is the UN and now everything's hunky-dory. You can't rebuild a country from behind a machine gun. And as long as we continue to try to do that, we will continue to fail in Iraq. I think, you know, as a vet, as a father of someone who's on active duty, and as the son of a man who spent 2 years of his early 20s in Vietnam, and a grandson of a man who landed on the beaches of Normandy, I think that one of the things that bothers me the most about hearing the continue the occupation argument is this thing about we have to finish the job. I'm not sure that anyone can quite define that job that we're supposed to finish. And also, you know, that's the same stuff that I read in the history books that people were saying in 1970 and 71 and 72. You know, when Nixon came with his secret plan to end the Vietnam War and ended up putting 30,000 extra names on that wall in D.C., I think that's what finishing the job is. You know, I think this if we stop fighting now, all those who have died will have died in vain. I think that was the talk that was coming out of the bunker in Berlin in 1945. Not to draw parallels, but I think it's the same kind of mentality. From this day forward, every Iraqi, every American, every Spaniard, every Italian that dies in Iraq will have died in vain. They will not die to protect and defend anyone's constitution. They will have died for oil interest in American empire, and that is a crime against humanity. This war dehumanizes all who participate in it. James Jones wrote in The Thin Red Line, "War does not ennoble men, it turns them into dogs." My friend Stan Goff is a retired Special Forces Master Sergeant, recently wrote a very powerful piece called "Hold On to Your Humanity." It's targeted at active duty soldiers. And it's a long message, but I'm just gonna read you one paragraph. Stan knows what he's talking about. He served in 7 conflict areas. He was in Vietnam when he was 19 years old. And this is his message to GIs. "You will do what you have to do to survive, however you define survival, while we do what we have to do to stop this war. But do not surrender your humanity, not to fit in, not to prove yourself, not for an adrenaline rush, not to lash out when you're angry and frustrated, not for some ticket-punching military careerist to make his bones on, and especially not for Bush, Cheney, Gas and Oil Consortium." Today, when I got up in Fayetteville and was coming to New York City for the second time in my life, and this place is terrifying. I opened up the paper, and like on Wednesdays they have this teen section where they ask kids, you know, what do you think of the latest Britney Spears album or whatever. And the question in this week's paper was, what will be the biggest Christmas wish for during this holiday season? And they interviewed 6 kids, all of them 13, 12, 11. "I think what most people are asking for this Christmas is for their father to come home from Iraq. This year, I don't think there's one object or present that I want. I just think a lot of people want their families to come home." Jesus. And the last one, I think, and the most poignant one, is this kid, Gerald Huggins, 12 years old. "I think they might want the wars to stop and to be home." And those are the kids that are in the community that I live in. I work in the school system. I see children in tears every day. You know, when you hear on the news that 2 Americans were killed last night by RPG fire in Mosul, or it's just the same thing that you heard on the news yesterday and the day before that and the day before that. And I grew up with my father in Vietnam, and I remember being on playgrounds at Fort Bragg, North Carolina in the early 1970s and seeing the casualty notification car turn into the neighborhoods and watching all the children run screaming home from the playgrounds. That's the reality that I grew up in, and that's what we have an entire generation of children on military bases growing up with today. You know, forget politics. This is about human beings' lives. So I just want to close by saying that last July, when a man in probably the safest building in the entire world, behind bodyguards, behind a desk, wearing a suit, looked at television cameras and told people who would shoot at young men and women, like the child that I have serving the military, to bring them on, I just want to say to him, don't say bring them on. Say bring them home, and bring them home now, please.
I'd like to introduce our next speaker, and that's going to be Sarah Zaidi, and she's the science director and one of the founders of the Center for Economic and Social Rights here in New York. She's a former MacArthur Fellow and Population Council Fellow at the Harvard Center for Population and Development Studies, where she conducted research in the areas of child mortality and nutritional status, sanctions, environmental health, and population dynamics. Her articles have appeared in such journals as Environmental Impact Assessment Review, Medicine and Global Survival, the New England Journal of Medicine, Lancet, and the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs. And Sarah has just returned from Afghanistan.
Afghanistan's been almost a year, so it's been a while. But I wanted to thank the organizers for putting together this great event, and I feel very honored to be part of this distinguished panel. In my presentation today, I will discuss whether the American drive for global dominance made explicit after September 11th is a logical extension of past policies or a radical break, examine American occupation in Iraq and Afghanistan, and present international human rights law as an alternative based on my experience as a human rights activist with the Center for Economic and Social Rights for now about 10 years, and someone who has spent some time visiting and researching conditions in both Iraq and Afghanistan since the early 90s. Since September 11th, the Bush administration has rolled out a well-conceived plan to reshape American foreign policy with astounding efficiency. In so doing, they have defeated not only liberal, progressive, and libertarian opinions, but also sectors of the American political elite, including the State Department and the CIA. They have succeeded despite opposition from the vast majority of the world's peoples and governments. How did this happen? Well, first and foremost, U.S. policy has always been rather militaristic and has become even more extraordinarily militarized. Despite economic recession, American taxpayers have funded a huge budget increase for the Pentagon and the new Homeland Security Department, even while social programs are being starved and joblessness and poverty continue to increase. A $500 billion budget surplus has been transformed into a $500 billion deficit in a matter of months. Soon after coming to power, the new conservatives at the Pentagon unveiled a set of new doctrines aimed at establishing, in their own words, full-spectrum global dominance in a unipolar world. The goal was to prevent, by all means necessary, any other state or group of states from even considering a challenge to American hegemony. The agenda of this group was advanced even before the election and even earlier than that in the Project for the New American Century. The project made it clear that the America, and I quote here in their mission statement that they have, stands as the world's most preeminent power, and all it requires is a military that is strong, a foreign policy that boldly and purposefully promotes American principles abroad, and a national leadership that accepts U.S.'s global responsibility. What has this meant? This has meant an openly unleashing of the full force and the largest and most effective and destructive military machine the world has ever seen. The rest of the world appears powerless given the simple fact that the U.S. military is so much bigger than anyone else's. If you just look at the U.S. military budget, which is about $400 billion, it far outstrips the next closest competitor, which is the U.K., at about $35 billion. Well, since launching wars is not really permitted in this new world outside the narrow legal limits of self-defense, imminent attack, or Security Council resolution, the U.S. has chosen to challenge and undermine the system of international law. First in Afghanistan and then in Iraq, they were both invaded without international legal authority. International mechanisms for conflict resolution and armed controls were sabotaged, while the UN itself was publicly mocked as a weakless debating society, and the Security Council was utterly disregarded. Public promises of aid and reconstructions have been broken with impunity in the case of Afghanistan. In Iraq, we're seeing a wholesale corporate buyout of public goods to companies embedded in the Bush administration, such as Bechtel, Halliburton, Brown Root, and Kellogg. And meanwhile, other countries are threatened with American-style freedom, as noted recently in a New Yorker article, who the reporter cites a company commander who says, and I quote, "When the Peace Corps can't quite get it done, and diplomacy fails, and McDonald's can't quite build enough franchises to win Baghdad over, that's when the military comes in," end quote. These actions not only violate specific rights and principles, but actually seek to dismantle the entire post-World War II legal framework of collective security, imperfect as it is. The new Bush doctrine of preventive war is simply a repackaging of Germany's justification for unilateral invasion. This was rejected at the Nuremberg Tribunal as, and I quote, "the supreme international crime," close quote. Today, it is being termed humanitarian intervention, but the principle remains the same, the unilateral and unrestricted rule of the strong. It is, frankly, imperialism. The political discourse used to justify these policies comes straight from George Orwell's worst nightmare. And even George Soros has recently remarked that the Bush's America reminds him of Hitler's Germany. He said 1930s, but I've sort of interpreted that. The world is divided neatly into good and evil. We Americans are good. Anyone opposing us is evil. We will hunt down and eliminate evil to the last terrorist through a global war that, in the words of Dick Cheney, may not end in our lifetime. So war is peace, invasion is liberation, and occupation is freedom. Now, throughout history, those who seek power and profit have disguised military conquest as a noble sacrifice by the strong to bestow the fruits of civilization upon the weak. Always, it has been about ending local tyrannies and bringing freedom and justice to the natives, whether they want it or not, and regardless of the cost to them. As the U.S. seems to be following this familiar pattern from its historic origins in a genocidal form of manifest destiny to its current role as unwelcome liberator of the Arab world. However, this familiar pattern is taking place in a seemingly new circumstance because we claim to be beyond the age of empire. We've constructed a somewhat of a multilateral system, or so we say. Yet the American empire is being built after World War II in a post-colonial world after the creation of the UN, after the wars of decolonization, after self-determinations and human rights have been accepted in principle, not by the overwhelming majority of the world's governments, but more importantly, by the overwhelming majority of its peoples. In my view, the architects of the United Nations, by putting human rights on an equal footing with peace and development, laid the seeds for revolutionizing international relations by establishing real accountability to universal standards of justice. I should add, I'm writing a book researching the historic origins of human rights within the United Nations, and so a large part of this is based on that. And so what happened was that the World War II victorious power, which was basically the US, the Great Britain, and USSR, and then China and France were brought in, co-opted the idea of human rights to sort of fight Hitler's Germany. Yet they recognized the dangers of it and tried to contain it so there would be no meaningful enforcement mechanisms, even in legally binding human rights treaties that followed the 1948 Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Because following a true human rights agenda would have required fundamental redistribution of political and economic power. After all, the reality back then was Jim Crow still reigned in the United States, and Churchill was not about to sanction the dismantling of the British Empire, and Stalin had already declared his expansionist policies and had them reaffirmed at Yalta. So one critique of human rights has been that it's a Western concept manipulated by powerful states like the United States to justify self-interested policies. But this critique makes a mistake of allowing human rights violators to define and distort the meaning of the words themselves, robbing us of the collective power of genuine human rights solidarity. Because Bush's speechwriters define war as peace and occupation as democracy, should we then abandon the banners of peace and democracy? Human rights are nothing more or less than the modern incarnation of our timeless search for universal justice. The simple idea that each of us, as individuals and members of social and national groups, are entitled to live in dignity. We are entitled to basic civil, political, and social and economic cultural freedoms. These are not abstract legal principles, but deeply felt desires of most humanity. I mean, if you go into Afghanistan or Iraq, you ask them, what is it that you want for yourselves, for your children? They all want education, they want security, they want jobs, they recognize they want food on their table, they want health care. The first of these rights, which they all want, upon which all others depend, is the right to self-determination. This is why it is placed as an article in both of the major international human rights treaties, which is the Civil and Political Rights and the Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights Treaties. I believe that a human rights framework, because it offers a positive vision of the future and creates opportunities for global solidarity between all people resisting all forms of injustice and oppression, whether it's imperialism, racial or gender discrimination, political persecution, or economic exploitation. At the moment, in our current history, it offers the most logical and effective umbrella within which to unite global forces for freedom and social justice across national, religious, class, and other barriers. Progress is always a struggle. It's taken popular movements in the U.S. 200 years to extend the protections of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness beyond the narrow privilege of white men with property to include women, workers, blacks, and minorities. So regardless of who occupies the White House, Baghdad, or any other place, we must speak out to make human rights a reality in our world for us and for future generations. Thanks.
On to our next speaker. Meredith Kladner is an organizer for the ISO here in New York. She's a contributor to both the magazine ISR and its sister publication, Socialist Worker, on topics such as the politics of the Transport Workers Union and the global justice movement. Before 9/11, Meredith was active in the global justice movement, building from mobilizations to protest the IMF, the World Bank, the FTAA in Quebec, and also in Genoa. She's also been active in organizing against the war in Afghanistan, as well as building anti-war forces for the historic demonstration that took place around the world on February 15th. She was active in New York. She remains a part of United for Peace and Justice, which is a sort of coalition umbrella group for anti-war forces. And Meredith has just gotten back from the mobilization against the FTAA in Miami, and she's going to talk.
So I just want to start by saying what an honor it is to be part of this panel. Every single speaker up here, their contributions as activists and authors, whether it's in the last year or two or the last couple of decades, has been hugely significant for our movement, and it's great to be able to be part of this discussion. What I really want to start with, though, is how much has changed in the last 6 months that we're sitting here today, not under the shadow of a victorious, unstoppable Bush administration, but instead within a growing international opposition, which is presenting itself more visibly and more forcefully in places like Europe and Latin America, but which is expanding and growing and spreading here in the United States as well. There is a tremendous and bubbling anger, I think, that exists among people who live in this country that the people who run this country can't even imagine is there. And I just want to read a letter quickly from a woman who has more reason than anyone in the world to care what happens with the U.S. empire in the coming months and years. Her name is Marion Brown, and she lives in Michigan. She says, "I'm a mother, 52 years old, and my son is in the National Guard. They might send him overseas on Friday. I'm mad. Of course I'm mad. I'm a mother. Let me tell you what being a mother is, if you don't know. It begins with having a child. You're a young girl and you give birth. Wow, what a birth. My son took 38 hours of hard labor to give birth to, but I don't care how much pain it was now because he was worth it. His name is Bobby. He was named after his dad who died in a terrible work accident when Bobby was 11. I pretty much raised him alone. He was taught by me to be kind. I did the best I could to raise all three of my boys. I tried to teach them kindness, compassion, and empathy. Maybe I should have taught them something else. Don't trust the U.S. government. Who would have ever thought that Bush would now be on the verge of allowing my son to die? I have spent 25 years watching my son grow into a man of decency, kindness, and goodness. I know he will be deployed to God knows where. And for what? For a spoiled frat boy with no integrity and no compassion who will murder him for money and for his corporate friends. I'm mad. I'm furious. I raised a wonderful young man. No one, I mean no one, has a right to take him from me." And this is just, yeah. And this is just one mother in one town recounting one experience that's being repeated over and over again throughout this country. It's led to groups like the one that Lou is helping to lead and to build. It's why the tens of thousands of people who marched on October 25th against the occupation to bring the troops home now were led by 1,000 veterans and military families. And while the war and the occupation is the defining political feature, I think right now in terms of politics in the U.S., it is not the only battlefront. If you look at the domestic issues, I think Bush is facing opposition he didn't expect either. If you were in Miami last month, through the tear gas, the pepper spray, peering past the Star Wars meets Matrix RoboCop things, you saw steelworkers from the Midwest, what the media and the politicians like to call the stereotypical patriotic American marching against the FTAA and free trade and the pro-free market dictates that it stands for. They were marching and chanting, "Stop the bullshit," and wearing bumper stickers slightly altered from that red, white, and blue United We Stand thing that popped up everywhere after 9/11. This one still had an American flag, but instead of "United We Stand," they said "United My Ass." And no wonder, really. I mean, 3 million jobs lost since Bush took office in the U.S. Ohio alone has lost 1 out of 6 manufacturing jobs, so that 2 million people of that state's 11 million person population resorted to food charities last year, and this in the U.S. empire. Nationwide, 1.7 million people fell into poverty last year, with a poverty line that's criminally low. It's $15,000 for a family of three. Still, 1 in 8 people in the U.S. lives in poverty. So is it any wonder that at one of the labor forums in Miami, a man named Dave Bavard, who's about to be a laid-off steelworker, echoed Ralph Nader and referred to the current state of things as, quote, "government of the corporations, by the corporations, and for the corporations." And so I think what we have is a revival of opposition in the U.S., and not just in places like New York City and San Francisco. There are 5 books attacking the president that have been on the USA Today bestseller list since August, including "Dude, Where's My Country?" "Lies and the Lying Liars Who Tell Them," my personal favorite title, "Bushwhacked, The Great Unraveling," and "The Lies of George Bush." And so if you remember back just this summer, Karl Rove and all the nasty right-wing campaign manipulators thought that they had a ready-made campaign commercial of Bush triumphantly landing on the aircraft carrier in his flight suit, or in somebody else's flight suit. And now you just fast forward 3 months, and Bush and company are trying to blame random soldiers for having made the mission accomplished banner that they were hoping was going to be the backdrop of their campaign. And so it looks like instead of Bush as an action figure, you know, acting as Tom Cruise in their next campaign ad, they might have to settle for Bush as Julia Childs serving turkey to troops in a tent in Baghdad airport, surrounded by mounds of militarized Secret Service agents, guarded by Black Hawk helicopters and tanks in constant rotation for the 2.5 hours that he managed to stay in the country. So instead of being Bush's crowning achievement and his reelection platform, Iraq could actually be Bush's undoing. The Bush administration has gone from completely unbeatable to vulnerable within the space of 6 months, with Bush's approval ratings dropping below where they were before 9/11. And so there's a sense in the U.S. that Bush can be beaten, that those of us who oppose a U.S. empire are not a tiny minority, but have a huge audience instead. And the question, I think, facing us will be, what will the political shape of that opposition be? And what role, from our perspective, I think, can left-wing politics play within it? I don't think anyone can answer that question decisively, nor do I think we would want anyone to be able to answer that question. Movements and oppositions have their own shapes and own tempos and own sources, which can't be dictated by any one group or individual. But there are political debates to be had and discussions to be made about how to move forward. And so I just wanted to offer a few thoughts on what things look like now. And as someone coming from an anti-capitalist perspective, what the challenges are facing our movement as a whole, and also for those of us who want to see fundamental and systematic change. I think opposition to the effects of the drive for U.S. empire are coming up in different ways. You can see it inside the anti-war movement, inside the re-emerging global justice movement, the revival of some workplace struggles, and also within the campaign focused on election 2004. I think while a lot of activists are trying to figure out how do we get more people involved, how do we get more people out on the streets, it is, of course, a political question, not just an organizational one. For all of the radicalization and the opposition in the U.S. right now, we are lacking some of the vehicles we need to take that opposition and make it into a political power, a political expression. The movements are recovering, but they're still somewhat scattered, and we're just finding our feet again. And I think for the Democrats, who pose themselves as the political voice, really, of people who oppose the status quo, it's somewhat of a problem. It is, of course, I think a very positive sign that a number of Democrats are leading Bush in the polls and that someone like Howard Dean is the front runner. People want to get rid of Bush. They don't want mealy-mouthed opposition. They want someone who criticizes him and opposes him. But I think that the problem for the movement is that the alternative offered by the Democrats, specifically by Dean, is primarily rhetorical. And someone like Dean, among other things, wants to send more troops in to strengthen the occupation in Iraq. So it may feel like we're getting somewhere if anyone but Bush gets elected. And I understand that great motivation to get that bastard out of there. But I don't think that it's going to feel any different to the Iraqis or to the American soldiers or to U.S. workers here who are struggling to maintain their health care and be able to pay their rent. If just anybody but Bush gets in. So I guess what I'm saying is I think there needs to be a fundamental realignment about the way we think about these things, that as formal politics move more and more to the right, that those of us who oppose the whole project of trading blood for oil, those of us who believe that prioritizing the health of corporate America over the health of American people, that we need a voice that doesn't just sound different but actually does something different. The other political challenge I think we're facing as a movement, or one of them, is building connections between the various movements that are emerging, because they're coming up on, they have connections, but they're coming up on somewhat different tracks. And again, I think this is as much political as it is organizational. If you look at the multiple fronts that they're building their empire on, military, political, and economic, Naomi Klein has a great article in The Latest Nation, and she puts it this way. She says, if every last soldier was pulled out of the Gulf tomorrow and a sovereign government came to power, Iraq would still be occupied. Order 39 decreed that foreign firms can retain 100% ownership of Iraqi banks, mines, and factories, and allowed these firms to move 100% of their profits out of Iraq. The Economist declared the new rules, quote, a capitalist dream. So if that's how they're building their empire, then our opposition has to be built on those fronts as well. And you could see the beginnings of some of those political and economic connections and military connections happening that are so necessary in Miami in the anti-FTA protests. For the first time since 9/11, really, all of the components that made up the global justice movement before that exploded in Seattle were back working together and making connections. There was not necessarily a formal statement on the war there, but it was referred to by many speakers, and there was a real openness to talking about what a disaster the occupation was and the need to bring the troops home. And when a U.S. steelworker made a speech that was critical of Bush administration policy, he mentioned that Bush claimed that we went into Iraq to promote freedom and democracy. And from the audience that was filled with thousands of steelworkers, you could hear cries of bullshit, bullshit, in reference to the idea that Iraq was about freedom and democracy. There was even a plan in Miami for everyone to converge in the afternoon, the direct action activists and the people in the labor march. That was agreed to by both sides so that people who wanted to march in the labor march could also join the direct action. Due to what was phenomenal police repression, people were driven from the reconvergence area by about 4 or 4:30. However, I would bet anything that a bunch of those steelworkers and other union members would have joined on the assault on the fence. They were that fed up and that angry, and they were planning to do so. So I think that that's a very brief sketch, but the process is really in its beginning stages. The unions, you know, there's steps forward, and then there's also some obstacles. The unions, while standing under banners proclaiming global justice and a better world is possible, and there were fantastic international speakers in Miami, also see, you know, their partnership with the steel bosses as being as important as their connections with the global workers' movement, and that's a contradiction. But I think these things and others are really just all part of how a movement rebuilds and finds its feet. And the general direction in Miami specifically was very positive. And the spring is going to present more opportunities for broadening the movement and clarifying political questions. March 20th is emerging as a global day of protest against the war. And then a month later in Washington, D.C., the IMF and World Bank will be meeting. Also, some of the workplace struggles going on. Grocery workers in California are really showing the way with a very combative strike against a very profitable supermarket chains trying to protect their health care, and they're getting a lot of solidarity from some of the other unions out there. So just to try to conclude, I think that the coming together of these movements will be a political process, but what happens in that process through the ups and downs of the movements that are going to be inevitable, I think is vitally important. When you look at the project that the U.S. has embarked on that I think Sarah was talking about, we have to make the connections in our movements because that's what their empire is based on. George Kennan of the U.S. State Department at the very beginning of the Cold War said this, and I think it applies today. We have about 50% of the world's wealth, but only 6.3% of its population. In this situation, we cannot fail to be the object of envy and resentment. Our real task in the coming period is to devise a pattern of relationships that will permit us to maintain this disparity without positive detriment to our national security. And I think this remains the task of America's rulers today. The U.S. emerged from the Cold War as the dominant imperialist power, but there's a fear among the ruling elite that that might not last. And so that's what their job is. And I think the job of the Bush administration and whatever administration comes next will be to maintain this U.S. dominance. The U.S. sees its tasks simultaneously as dominating militarily, economically, abroad, and while also keeping its own working class working as hard as possible for as little as possible. Their problem, though, is that they constantly and continuously underestimate the resistance that they will encounter. And it is, in fact, the Iraqi resistance, which they arrogantly dismissed, that's fueling the revival of opposition against the occupation here in the U.S. and around the world. And similarly, even though the FTAA talks, you know, they came out with FTAA light and they ended a day early, and the WTO talks in Cancun collapsed partially due to competition between different ruling elites in different countries, but also because of the social and workers' movements in Latin America, which threatened the regimes there and pushed the confrontations and made those agreements impossible to come to. So I think, just to wrap up, our job in the U.S. is to patiently but urgently build our movement so that we too can be an actual force in what, you know, deciding what the U.S. does and doesn't do. But we're in a more powerful position even because we're doing it from within. I don't think that there's a mood for compromise, particularly hovering above the White House, the Pentagon, or the corporate boardrooms these days. So as we figure out how to stop their plans, I also think it's very urgent that we figure out how to build an alternative to what's becoming a more and more bloody, profit-driven system. Another world is possible, but it's also incredibly necessary when farmers can grow too much grain so that they become poor because there's too much food on the market, while literally hundreds of millions of people starve. You have to say there's something wrong with this system. So when we join together to fight the occupation, the FTAA, the attacks on living standards and on immigrants right here at home, if we want fundamental and lasting changes, I think we have to make sure that the system itself, which is based on profit at the expense of humanity, should also be something that's in our crosshairs.
Okay, before Tariq speaks, I think that there are two things that are going to happen. Somebody from Al Alda is here who's going to give solidarity greetings from the floor. Is that right? All right, well, Mustafa, you're going to, why don't you come up here and, do you want to use this?
That's okay. This works. I'm just going to make a brief announcement about something going on in Egypt.
Louder.
Not only is the U.S. Incapable of bringing democracy to Iraq, I actually think that the U.S. is the biggest obstacle to democracy in Iraq and in the Middle East, because if there is real democracy, then workers in that part of the world would control the oil and control their destiny, and definitely the U.S. doesn't want anything like that. And that's why they support many dictatorships across the Middle East. Country where I'm from is Egypt. The regime of President Hosni Mubarak is supported by the United States. Egypt is the second largest recipient of U.S. aid, and it uses that to carry out massive political repression against anyone who opposes the U.S. or opposes Israeli policies in the area. And recently, in April, they arrested one of my friends. He's been in jail for 6 months, and they're looking for four others. So they have five people going on trial on December the 16th. They're anti-war activists. They're charging them with the crime of organizing a demonstration against the war in Iraq. And the second one is passing sensitive information about human rights abuses to Amnesty International over the email. And they face up to 20 years in jail. And the trial opens on December the 16th. So we put together a petition that we want as many people as possible tonight and other people to sign, to send to the president of Egypt to demand that we drop all the charges against these activists. We want to show our solidarity here. We're part of a global movement for justice. So the petition will be circulating, and I hope you guys can sign it. And this petition will be read, hopefully, at the International Anti-War, Anti-Neoliberal Policies Conference, which opens in Cairo on December the 13th, where thousands of people from around the Middle East and around the world will be gathering in Cairo to have meetings like this to talk about the next steps in the war against empire. So thanks.
Okay, so now to introduce the final speaker of the evening. He was born in 1943 in Lahore in what was then British-controlled India, somebody who knows something about empire. Tariq Ali was educated in Pakistan and then at Oxford. His opposition to the military dictatorship in Pakistan during the 1960s led to permanent exile in Britain. He was active in the anti-war movement in Europe during the late 60s against the war in Vietnam. Tariq is a long-standing editor of New Left Review and has written more than a dozen books on history and politics as well as novels. His book, The Clash of Fundamentalisms, with a very funny picture of Bush on the front cover, Crusades, Jihad, and Modernity, is an international bestseller. And his newest book, which you I think can purchase in the back, is Bush in Babylon, The Recolonization of Iraq. And I also just want to mention that in a January-February issue of the International Socialist Review, there's going to be an interview with Tariq by David Barsamian running there. So join me in a very warm welcome to Tariq Ali.
Well, thank you very much. It's very good to be here again. And be speaking with you. I was in agreement with what's been said from the platform already, and extremely moved by the speech made by our brother from North Carolina. This is an extremely important component of the anti-war movement, and those of you who recall how the Vietnam War was brought to an end will remember it was not only the epic and heroic resistance of the Vietnamese, which of course was absolutely crucial. It was the growth of the anti-war movement in the United States, and most importantly, the growth of the GIs against the war and the veterans against the war who used to march in tens of thousands outside the Pentagon, that finally convinced the establishment in this country that it was impossible to carry on the war any further. So the presence of our friend here is something which we are very grateful for, and we need many more like him. And the infection is spreading. Today, as I, hours ago when I boarded a plane at London to come here, I was reading my newspaper and something struck me. It should have been the big front page story, but it was buried inside even the British newspaper, which is that over a dozen Israeli pilots of Black Hawk helicopters and bomber jets have said that they will no longer go and bomb Palestine. And they have said, moreover, the statement they gave was, we are prepared to defend our country, but our country is not under attack, and we are Air Force pilots. We are not like members of the mafia sent out to carry out revenge killings. So, slowly, as long as a resistance carries on in the Arab world, it has an effect. Naturally, it has an effect. If the Palestinian resistance today is having an effect inside Israel, where many ordinary Israelis and Israelis within the army and now the Air Force are being affected by it, and they're saying, we will not go and kill innocent people anymore, that's an extremely important development. And the fact that there are all the, I mean, I may have missed some, but all the interviews I read with American soldiers home on leave, on furlough, in the United States press, there's one thing they all say, whatever else they don't say. They say one of the worst things of being in Iraq is that people, ordinary people, on the streets, look at us with anger, bitterness, and hatred in their eyes. And this is something we can't accept. And the reason they can't accept it is because the politicians lied to them. The politicians told them, A, that Blair and Bush told them our countries were threatened because this regime had weapons of mass destruction. Not true. Secondly, they told them that when you reach there, you will be welcomed with sweets and flowers. Not true. That didn't happen either. Instead, they confronted, from the very first days, a passive resistance. That's what people don't write about all that much. But all the information coming out of Iraq, it says that even in those parts of the country where there was real hostility to Saddam Hussein, there is anger. And recently, a senior British Foreign Office official, Sir Jeremy Blackstock, who was at the United Nations, a pretty despicable figure, actually, I thought. But even he was forced to say, in public, there is no doubt that the bulk of Iraqis detest the occupation. Now, what are we to make of all this? What we are to make of all this is that certainly some of us aren't surprised. We warned them that this is what would happen, and it's happening. And it's happening, and it's growing. And they're beginning to lie about it. So 3 days ago, 2 days ago, in the Iraqi city of Samarra, what happened? You had an ambush, which is what guerrilla fighters do. Once they had started ambushing the US Army there, people emerge from the streets, ordinary citizens, and build barricades to trap the trucks. The United States, the soldiers started opening fire quite wildly. They announced that they had killed 52 Iraqis. And the Iraqis, who are normally very quick in counting their own dead, said no. They have only killed 8 and wounded 10 others. That's all. And of the 8 they've killed, only 2 are guerrillas. The others are ordinary civilians. And 2 are Iranian pilgrims on their way to the holiest Shia shrine in Samarra. So the Iranian government has now formally objected and asked the Iraqi National Council, so-called, to conduct an investigation as to how their pilgrims got killed. So the reason I'm telling you this is because it's a familiar story. It was the same in Vietnam. The lies that were told in the early days of the war were very similar. I know perfectly well this isn't Vietnam. It's a different country, different time, different historical time. But nonetheless, once you start to occupy a country and colonize it, then the pattern of the resistance, whatever time you are in, is not dissimilar. If people don't like being occupied, what do? They fight. And the CIA figures of a guerrilla force of 50,000, the Iraqis say it's more, but let's accept the 50,000 figure. It's very high. It's very high for an armed force confronting an occupation in the first year of the occupation. That is a very high figure. More important than the figure of 50,000 or 100,000 or whatever is the fact that these people have the support of the population. How do we know that? Because till now, there have been very few cases of people taking the occupation soldiers and saying, there are the guerrillas. There was more of that, incidentally, in South Vietnam. Because the Catholic Church at that particular period in time was closely linked to the puppet regime in South Vietnam and played a very big part in pointing to where the National Liberation Front guerrillas were. In Iraq, we haven't had that. It's existed, but you know, one or two cases. It hasn't happened. If it had happened even with 10 or a dozen cases, they would have been highlighted. You would have seen people on television. You would have seen them being interviewed. You would have seen them in the press. It hasn't happened. And the reason it hasn't happened is people are not for the occupation. And incidentally, the interesting thing is that Even Bush Sr., when asked why he didn't take Baghdad during the first Gulf War, if you read what he said it's very difficult for us to occupy an independent Arab country. It will create real anger within the country. I mean, even he understood what it meant for Baghdad to be occupied by the United States Army. It's a historic capital of Arab civilization, of the Arab world. So people with some sense understood what it would mean. These guys didn't. They decided after 9/11, as has already been remarked, that they could go in and do what they wanted to do. And the answer they have got is they can't. You may be the world's most powerful nation in the world. You may have the best military technology the world has ever seen. You can have all that, but once you occupy a country with your own troops, exactly the same laws operate which operated 100 years ago or 50 years ago or 25 years ago, despite the technology. Once your own troops are there, technology is no good. Because if you decide to start bombing Baghdad, okay, you could bomb it. It's a city almost as sprawling as L.A., and with 6 or 7 million people. But who will you bomb? Where will your own soldiers be at the time? It becomes a difficult operation. So what the tactics of the occupation are, to restrict frontal encounters with the enemy as much as they can, to use Black Hawk helicopters to gun them down when they can, and to stop a rebellion in the United States, try and delay reintroducing the draft for as long as possible. How do you do that? By getting people from other parts of the world to come in and fight with you. Massive pressure is now being put on the various other states. The Arab states, of course, know it's suicide. I mean, no Arab state, whether Egypt or Saudi Arabia, the two states closest to the United States, will supply soldiers, because they know if they do it, it's the end of those regimes. That's one thing they can't do. So they're putting pressure on the Europeans. But the resistance is targeting of Italians and Spanish, you know, purely from a military and political point of view, has been very effective. It's created a big outcry in that country, as has the targeting of Japanese and South Koreans and Ukrainians and Poles. They're all in there in different capacities. And the reason they're in there so that the United States does not have to introduce the draft. Because if they do that, then it's the end. I'm just telling you that. If the draft is introduced in the United States, the anti-war movement will triple and quadruple within the next year. And they know that. So they're determined to stop that happening. So from their point of view, the situation is a complete mess. Have no doubt about it. The situation is a complete mess. And the big problem they face now, and what they're thinking about, because they're cynical operators, the big thing they're thinking about now is what can we do to create the impression that things aren't as bad as they are in order to get this great thinker president reelected. What are they going to do? They're thinking. He isn't, but they are. So what are they going to come up with? Pour in lots of money? Well, fine, that's not going to work. People will happily take the money and buy arms for the resistance. That's happened before. After all, don't forget the amount of money they poured into other parts of the world, where it filtered through to the resistance. So that's not going to work particularly well. Create the impression of all is calm, even for 2 or 3 months in the run-up to the election. In order to do that, you need to have some people on your side. And the people they have on their side are not sufficient to do that. The bulk of the people in this collaborators' council, apart from the Kurds and one Shia faction, who are the only two people with some real strength on the ground, the others are nobodies, absolute nobodies. So The only other thing, of course, is possibly to go for another country and create a situation that, you know, Syria is posing a threat. Somehow, I do not think the American population is going to buy that one. Given you're already in a mess in Iraq, to try and go for Syria or use the Israelis to go for Syria is not going to work either. So they are facing a real problem. And the Iraqi resistance is going to grow. And what the Iraqi resistance, obviously what they'll try to do, I mean, I'm sure the United States knows that and is devising methods to stop it, because it would be a tragedy for the poor soldiers who've been dragooned there by the politicians. But I'm sure that the resistance will try and score a big hit in the run-up to the election. They will do it, or attempt to do it. So it's going to be an extremely interesting year, where the United States will be desperate to try and calm the situation down, and the resistance will be absolutely desperate to ensure that George W. Bush is defeated. Because regardless of who defeats him, there's no doubt in my mind that a defeat for George Bush in the next elections will be seen globally as a defeat for these policies, regardless of who replaces him. And that will encourage a movement of resistance in different parts of the world. Obviously, no one will have any illusions about Wesley Clark, even if he gets close to it. Not to mention Hillary Clinton, who was so desperate that Bush had barely left Baghdad after a short 2.5 stay there. His so-called Thanksgiving visit, when she went for a quick trip as well and said, "We need more troops." And that's an indication of what that particular dominant wing of the Democratic Party is up to. But nonetheless, if there is a mass revulsion against Bush and people vote him out, it will be seen globally as a defeat for this particular tactical variant of the American empire. So it's a very interesting situation from that point of view. Now, the other point I want to make is this. It's extremely important to understand that though Bush is what people say he is and worse, this is nothing new. It's often people have short memories. But the American empire has been in existence now for a very long time. And initially it expanded internally. Its biggest expansion, when it got 70% of its territory, took place from between 1830 and 1850. When it took land belonging to neighboring states. And the ideologues of the empire then used to come up with very interesting ideas, saying if we see that a neighbor is creating troubles in his house, referring to Mexico, and there is trouble in a neighbor's house and it's dirty, I'm quoting directly, and it needs to be cleaned up, then it is our duty as good neighbors to go in and clean it up. This is the theory of imperialism as bad housekeeping. And so once they'd finished expanding the empire internally and extending it towards their neighbors, they then went on a big binge in order to develop their own strength and their own interests by taking on the Spanish and taking Cuba, the Philippines, Guam, and all these territories, which they did in the late years of the 19th century and the early years of the 20th century. So it's been a continuous battle, more or less, since the American Civil War. In fact, one way of uniting the new nation was to make it an imperial nation and to build an imperial ideology, which they did. The problems that were posed to them, and this is why you must always see that the empire's external and domestic needs are always like this. It's not that they you know, it's one leg here and one leg there. It's the two legs the empire walks on, and they are always linked up to each other. Big debate erupted in the United States in the middle of the 19th century about what to do with Puerto Rico. Should it become a part of the... I'm not saying what the Puerto Ricans thought. Let's leave that alone. It's what the American ruling elite thought. Should we bring it into the union? And then they said, no, we shouldn't bring it into the union because it'll mean that there are too many dark people will come into the United States, which could affect the population and the country as a whole. We don't need to bring them in. So what is Puerto Rico then? Well, we do own it, but it can't be part of the United States. And that was also the way they treated Guantanamo. Hence, not having it with American laws applying there, they can do anything they want. And similarly, there was also a very big debate which went on Hawaii, which was not dissimilar to this. Of course, Hawaii was incorporated and Puerto Rico wasn't. But these debates went on all the time because they were extremely worried about what was going on domestically and what the impact of the empire would be domestically. And this period I'm talking about is pre-1917, pre the Russian Revolution, long before communism was even a word in the lexicon. It had the American empire and its existence had nothing to do with the Cold War. It existed before. The Monroe Doctrine, after all, what did it have to do with the Cold War? Nothing. The control of Latin America and lots of other powers learned from the United States. When the Japanese invented the co-prosperity sphere to occupy all the countries surrounding them, they actually said, we learned this, this is our version of the Monroe Doctrine. If the United States can do it, why can't we do it? So the fact that the United States didn't directly occupy large parts of the world in the fashion of the colonial powers of Europe doesn't mean that they weren't an empire. That's the only basis for saying they weren't, which some people, you know, still insist on saying it. But that occupation of the Philippines and the war against the Philippines unleashed a mass movement in the United States, which involved large numbers of people, Mark Twain, Du Bois, Henry James, William James, who launched the Anti-Imperialist League in Chicago in 1898. And within a year, it had 250,000 members in 25 big cities in the United States. And I think the time is coming when similar initiatives need to be taken again and on this with the same breath, that it's no good just talking to ourselves. We need to have the broadest possible front against the empire in its very heart. That's what will... that's what will put pressure on them, and that's what will encourage soldiers to resist when they are told to go and fight a war under completely fake pretenses in total violation of international law. That's the tragedy which we're seeing now, because no one wants people to die, either Americans or Iraqis. It's the politicians who have basically pushed them in that direction. And the key politicians who did this, Bush here, is now a pariah, even in Britain, in the country of his closest ally. I mean, they sealed off large parts of London so he didn't see any demonstrators. But the demonstrators were everywhere. You know, they couldn't keep them out. It was covered massively. I don't know if it was in this country, but it certainly was all over the world. What was happening? I mean, I remember being asked by, you know, some idiot justifying these security precautions, saying, well, what if the terrorists kill Bush? I was asked on television. I said it would have to be a very stupid terrorist who wants Cheney as president. I mean, you know, what on earth, I said, are you going on about? As if there was a real threat, a real threat to kill Bush. It's just a complete joke. Basically, the guy's isolated globally. You know, he can't visit any country. He goes to countries like Thailand, Indonesia, big demonstration. He goes to Australia, massive demonstration. So they have to, Karl Rove or whoever was with him, had to rig a whole photo opportunity where he and the Australian Prime Minister standing on the steps of a plane and waving to nobody. you know, these photo opportunities, waving to nobody, because they couldn't take him, because there were no people, there was no one prepared to come out in favor of him. We said to the people in London, we said, look, why don't you organize a demonstration in favor of him? I said, surely it's not that difficult. But clearly it was. And so he mingled with the royal family and with Blair, and then he came back home. I mean, you know, this has never happened before, that an American president, the leader of the great empire, the leader of the world, etc., arrives in his favorite satrapy, his favorite satellite state, and there are no people to greet him. They couldn't even lay on, you know, they couldn't even lay on the army in civilian clothes because 2/3 of the army's in Iraq. So if he hadn't sent the army for Iraq, they could have been got out to cheer Bush. But they couldn't even do that. So the whole thing is a complete mess for both Bush and Blair, whose ratings are now going down. For the first time ever, the Conservatives, which is awful, the Conservatives in Britain are a few points ahead of Blair. No one thought that this could happen. And whenever people are asked why, they say the war in Iraq. They don't say the economy or this, that, and the other. Basically, they say the war in Iraq has finally disgusted us with this guy. We don't believe him. He lied to us. That's essentially what is going on. Now, what you have to do, and those of us who don't live in this country but feel its might, are really dependent on you. Because I always say this, in different parts of the world, especially where there's sort of no understanding of what the United States is like, and where people assume that official America is the only America that exists. And I always say, because I believe it, that's why I say it, that there is another America, that this America is not as large and not as dominant as the America that rules, but this America exists, it is oppositional, there are dissenting voices, and they will grow as they have done in the past. And so what happens in this country, and what you do as citizens of this country to resist the empire, will have a very big impact all over the world. You know, people, when I travel to different parts of the world, say, but could America ever be a force for the good? I said, yeah, of course it could, if it didn't have this ruling elite. Of course, with its power, with its technology, with its wealth, it could do work miracles in large parts of the world. But this is an elite which rules in its own interests. And these interests now, more than ever before, are corporate interests. You know, in the past they were two, but now we have reached a concentration of capital in this country, and the influence of this concentrated capital on politics has never been as high as this. It has reached its highest pitch, regardless of whether it's Republicans or Democrats. Republicans raise more money, but the Democrats under Clinton didn't do too badly either, for themselves or for them. And to bring them back home, and to bring them back home immediately. This argument, which often liberals who were opposed to the war use, yeah, okay, we were opposed to the war, but now that we are in there, shouldn't we stay in? What will happen to Iraq if we withdraw? And the answer to that is, Iraq couldn't be worse than it is now, so it will only get better if you withdraw. And even if there is chaos for a limited period of time, the different Iraqi groups and factions and parties and interests will come together to set up a national government. That's what the resistance has done now. And the resistance is now spreading to northern towns, and it's widespread in the south. It's decentralized. And this resistance is going to shape the future of Iraq, which in my opinion will not return to the Ba'athists. It will have to be a coalition of different forces ruling that country for the time being. I think that is absolutely clear. What is holding this development back and letting it move forward organically is the occupation. And that is why we say, if you were against the war, you have got to be against the occupation. Otherwise, it doesn't make sense. That's all. I'm a bit tired now.
For joining us tonight in this discussion. I think it's not on. Sorry. Just once again, want to thank all of the panelists for coming and joining us for this discussion tonight. There are going to be a couple of brief announcements, and we'll also be going to the West End, which is a big restaurant where people can continue this discussion that everyone is invited to. So you're going to be speaking from Al Auda, the Palestinian Right of Return.
Thank you, Dr. Tariq. Tariq Ali always attends our conferences, Al Auda rallies and conferences here, and he's always the highlight of every single conference. And apologies for my analysis. It's not going to be as sophisticated as his, obviously. But I would just like to say a few things about what's happening recently. In terms of Iraq, you know, in the beginning, now it's, of course, a military occupation, and everyone would agree with this. But in the beginning, we heard about weapons of mass destruction, then terrorists. Then I really couldn't keep record. You know, they didn't, I wonder if they did hunt down the terrorists. If you remember, Bush once said, post-September 11th, we will hunt them down. I need to expand my vocab, I think, as a Palestinian, so when I become prominent in the government, we can negotiate justice for Palestine. And I don't have to worry about difficulties, especially when explaining to him Zionism and what happened in 1948. Anyways, many people, including media, seem to be extremely, extremely excited about the Geneva Accords, hoping for a comprehensive solution to the Palestinian-Zionist conflict. I wonder if few self-selected Palestinian, along with few other Israelis, would actually be able to dissolve the apartheid system set forth in Palestine that goes unnoticed amongst Israelis, most Israelis, and mainstream media, and the imperialist powers of this world. What is most interesting about these Accords is that they do not account for 80% of the Palestinian population, since these agreements stipulate building a Palestinian state on most of the 1967 occupied territories, including East Jerusalem. These territories basically are 22% of historic Palestine. And since the word most is mentioned in building this Palestinian state, you must at least deduct another 5 to 7% of those 22%, if not more. There seems to be no problem with letting go of the right of return as a reality, as a concept, whatever, letting go of it in all shapes and forms. That's what it seems like they're up to. It is not realistic to the imperialist Zionist state to integrate or allow back the indigenous people they forcefully expelled and dispersed from their homeland in 1948. I wonder if it's possible to make sense of such agreements. Again, these agreements will only account to 20% of the Palestinian population, and basically forgetting about 80% of the Palestinians who continue to suffer on a daily basis in refugee camps and in diaspora. I'm sure many of you are aware of the Sabra and Shatila massacres in 1982, Deir Yassin, and other many massacres post-1948. If anything, these agreements suggest that we must forget about the atrocities committed by a colonial force against an indigenous population. The creation of the Zionist Israeli state in 1948 literally destroyed Palestinian society, mostly its peasants, workers, society dynamics, including the role of women. They changed the status of Palestinian peasants into a revolutionary one in refugee camps and diaspora. And one thing no one will ever be able to sign away is the fact that Palestinians will never give up their individual and collective, their cultural and individual rights to their homeland from which they were forcefully expelled from. I think we are the most realists, whether academics or revolutionaries, in knowing for a fact that the Palestinian-Israeli conflict will never be resolved without addressing the roots of injustice, which means acknowledging and complying with the right of return for the Palestinian people. Thanks.
And just before Lucy does an announcement, I do want to let people know that Tariq will be doing book signing up here after the announcements. Lucy.
Okay, just a quick, I work with United for Peace and Justice. Just a quick announcement. We've talked a lot tonight about the resistance within the military itself and how important that is. And, you know, last week Meredith talked about it while Bush made his little stealth two-hour photo op to Iraq. There was a delegation of 10 military families and veterans who were preparing for a trip to Iraq, a real trip, to actually see what's going on there and actually talk to the troops and actually talk to Iraqis about the conditions that they are enduring right now. These folks are coming to New York next week, in fact, and United for Peace and Justice and Global Exchange is sponsoring an event December 11th at Washington Square United Methodist Church at 7 p.m., that's Thursday, downtown, featuring speakers including Fernando Suarez de Solar, whose son died in the invasion of Iraq, and Medea Benjamin, co-founder of Global Exchange, as well as some of the other delegation folks as well as people to talk about some of the local organizing that's going on that people can plug into to help build the anti-war movement here in New York. There's also a demonstration December 18th that's being organized mostly by Brooklyn Parents for Peace, which is a Brooklyn peace group, as well as Veterans for Peace, Military Families Speak Out. Again, support the troops, bring them home now. It's in downtown Brooklyn on Thursday, December 18th, starting in front of Borough Hall and marching down Fulton Street, a holiday rally to bring the troops home now. It's a very important event. We have a bunch of flyers in the back of the room. I really encourage people to take flyers with them. We actually need help publicizing these events. And if people want to take flyers, put them up. There's also a sign-up sheet. If you can let us know where you're going to take the flyers to, we would greatly appreciate it. This is, again, some of the building blocks that we're going to need to build an movement against the occupation here in this country.
Yep, just very quickly, there are two other announcements that I think people might be interested in.
I'm with the campaign to end the death penalty, and while it's really important to continue to fight the war abroad and resist it, it's important to also fight the war that's coming at home as well. Tomorrow, there's going to be a demonstration in Brooklyn at the U.S. Attorney's Office. It's on 1 Pierman Plaza at Court Street, and it's Ashcroft right now is trying to expand the death penalty in New York, and he's coming in and he's overriding the decisions of the DAs here in New York and trying to expand it. It's completely undemocratic, and we want to stand up against it. So there's a table back there for the campaign to end the death penalty, or you can come. There's a lot of flyers, and it'd be great to have
all of you to be there to help us, because there's going to be a discussion and Q&A section. So please do come, show support for our position, and hope to see you there.
So yeah, come out and join us at the West End if you want more discussion. It's 115th and Broadway, on Broadway. Oh, 114th, sorry, 114th and Broadway.